John 1, 1 through 5. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. All things were created through him, and apart from him, not one thing was created that has been created. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and yet the darkness did not overcome it. This is the word of the Lord.
Historian. I'm an historian. I'm not a believer. But I must confess, as a historian, that this penniless preacher from Nazareth is irrevocably the very center of history. Jesus Christ is easily the most dominant figure in all history. And so, we're going to look at his life over the next 4 weeks and try to figure out why. Why is this homeless preacher the center of history? Let's look at John 1, 1 through 5, and what we're going to see is who he is, so his identity, what he brings, and then how you can get it, how you can get a piece. And so I'm going to start in John 1, 1 through 2. It says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Now, John has constructed his book, his gospel, to help people understand who Jesus is and why it matters for their life. And most gospels start with the Christmas story, you know, away in a manger and silent night kind of stuff. But John starts way back in the beginning. And in the Bible, in the beginning means in the beginning. Brings up Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth. So, at the beginning of all things was the Word. Was, not came into being, not became, but was, already in continuing existence. So this Word, who John is going to identify as Jesus of Nazareth, even before our story began, even before the story of the world began, was already in continuing existence. And he was with God, and he was God. With God is a word or a phrase that doesn't just mean like palling around side to side, hanging out, but it's the Greek word for like face-to-face relationship. Before there was anything, this Word, this Jesus, was already in continuing existence in face-to-face relationship with God. Now, think about it. There are no bodies. What does it mean to have a relationship like that? It's like your heart and your soul and your will and everything is wrapped up in each other. The Bible tells us that God exists as one God, but three persons. It's the Trinity. I can explain it. I do not understand it. It makes sense that we wouldn't be able to understand God because anything worthy of that title would be beyond our comprehension. All we can know about him is what he chooses to reveal and what we're capable of understanding. But this Logos, this Word, this Jesus, at the beginning, before everything started, was already in face-to-face relationship with God. And that means that at the very center of who God is a relationship of love and joy and self-giving and receiving, of healthy, flourishing relationship, a community, a family. And he was God. Now, there are some discrepancies in popular thought today about whether this was God or was a God. And we can get into the Greek of the definite article and its absence or presence. But most of us don't have a background with Jehovah's Witness. And so we're not going to be too concerned with that. So what we are concerned with is what is the claim that John is making? And what we need to know is that John is Jewish and Jesus is Jewish. And so they have a Jewish background. And the Bible, as they understand it, is the Old Testament. And so to say that Jesus, before our story began, was already in continuing existence and in relationship with God and was God, to use the word logos or word carried with it a very substantial claim. so substantial that, in fact, John could have just said, Jesus is the Word incarnate, and left it at that. And the Jewish background would have loaded that word with a ton of freight. And here's what the word means. So in the first century, there's a bunch of religious experts, the rabbis, who are doing good biblical theology and then writing books about it. And then those books get passed down to us, and we actually still have many of them today. And when they talk about the word, they're looking at their Bible and saying, this is what the word is. They're looking at the Old Testament and saying, this is who the word is. And here are the six things that they notice. The word is distinct from God, but the same as God. They're reading their Old Testament, and they're seeing that the word is distinct from God, but the same as God. The word is the agent of creation. They're looking at their Old Testament. They're looking at Genesis and seeing that God speaks and the world pops into existence, and that the word is the means of creation. The word is the agent of revelation. So the word is the way God discloses himself and his will. He doesn't just beam enlightenment into the heads of individuals, but instead he speaks. His word becomes the way he shares who he is, what he's about, and what he wants. The word is the means by which God becomes visible. So they're looking at the Old Testament, and they're seeing that every time the word shows up, God all of a sudden becomes visible. The word is the means by which God signs his covenants. He makes his promises. And then finally, the word is the agent of salvation. The word is the way God rules and reigns and protects and guides and the way that he is king over his people. And wouldn't you know that these six things that the rabbis, independent of Christianity, have put in their theology books are the very same things that John hits on in this first chapter. So this Jesus, John is claiming, is the pre-existent second person of the Trinity. He is distinct from God, but he is the same as God. He shares his essence. He's the agent of creation, the agent of revelation, the way that God becomes visible and signs his covenants, and the way he reigns and saves. So the summary of just this opening salvo would be, at the time when all created things were created, the Logos, one eternal person, was already in continuing existence, and the Logos was already in face-to-face relationship with God, and the Logos was God. Now, what about the Logos? Because John isn't just writing to Hebrew people. He's writing to Greek speakers, and so he writes in Greek. And Logos is a very important word that means word, but it had become a technical term in the first century. And some of you are familiar with it, but the basic gist is this, that the Logos was used to convey the divine reason implicit in the cosmos, ordering it, giving it form and meaning. And it was the reason for being, the very foundation. The Logos was the reason, the meaning of life, the purpose. It was everything. But the problem with the first century is that they could all these Greek philosophers could agree that there was a reason for being, that there was a foundation to the universe. This wasn't all an accident. There is a purpose and a direction in life, but they couldn't agree on what that was. It was this abstract principle, and it was just out of grasp. They couldn't understand what the Logos was, and so they started coming up with differing ideas, trying to search for what is the reason, what is the meaning at the base of the universe. The Stoics believed that the meaning, the supreme value at the base of the universe was virtue. The Epicureans believed it was pleasure, and not like what we think of as pleasure today, you know, eat and drink, tomorrow you die, but more like pursuing goodness apart from suffering and pain. So you've got the Stoics who, you know, no surprise, are not the party people. And then you've got the party people, right? And some of you are leaning in one direction or maybe more the other, because we all have to have a meaning to life. There has to be something that rules the way that we live, some purpose we're here for. Without knowing what your purpose is, how do you even continue to exist? I mean, this is despair, right? When we get to a place of total despair, life is no longer valuable or worth living. So you have to have a purpose. You have to have meaning in your life. You have to have something. But if you're just kind of guessing at it, then you're going to be like my truck. My truck has a heater in it. It does not make a very good heater. And if I decided that I would pull it into my garage and open the kitchen door and turn the heater on full blast and use my truck to heat my home, it'd be a waste of a perfectly good truck. It'd be a waste of a lot of gas, but it'd be really dangerous. The truck is made for a purpose. It's a vehicle. It's meant to get me from here and there and all that kind of stuff. It's not meant to be a heater. To the extent that you understand what your purpose is in this life is the extent to which you can flourish. But if you start making up your own rules, if you make up your own meaning, then you're just going to be like my truck. Not only a waste of potential, but also it'll be dangerous to your health. You'll be doing things you weren't designed for. You'll be living in a way you weren't made for. So let's look at what that has to do with Jesus. If he is the reason, he is the meaning to life, he is the purpose, then he can tell you what your purpose is. He can show you. He can give it to you. He can give you a reason for being alive and a way to live out that life. And that's where we go next, and what he brings. In verses 3 and 4, it says, "All things were created through him, and apart from him, not one thing was created that has been created. In him was life, and that life was the light of men." Jesus is the creator. He is the author, and therefore he has authority. How many people have seen The Shining? How many people are familiar with The Shining? Yeah, there we go. Yeah, here's Johnny. Terrifying, right? That book, if you've read it, or that movie, is absolutely terrifying. It's about an author and his family who go to be caretakers at a ski chalet in the off-season, partially filmed in Oregon at the Timberline Lodge. Love it. Yep. Woo-woo. Oregon represent. Okay, so... but... it's terrifying. He like doesn't write anything except for all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, and he starts terrorizing his family, and you're not sure, are like demons involved? What is going on in this thing? There's all these ghosts in the... Now, who gets to tell you what that movie is about? The author. And did you know that Stephen King wrote that book to explore his alcoholism? That's what The Shining's about. It's about alcoholism. It's not about like a scary guy who's losing his mind writing a book. The author gets to tell you what the story is about. The author gets to wield authority over meaning and purpose and the way to live that out. Now, you might disagree with Stephen King in the movie, but you're going to miss the deeper meaning. You're going to miss the point. Likewise, you might disagree with Jesus and say, "I can't live my life like that. If I did that, like, nobody'd take me seriously, or I'd lose everything. I'd have to give up the things that I hold most dear." But that's saying I disagree with my purpose, and I'm going to try and live in a way that I wasn't actually designed for, and I'm going to be a truck that tries to heat up a whole house and kills the owners. Right? See, there are two categories. Did you see that? All things were created through him. So there's things that have been created and exist. And apart from him, not one thing was created that has been created. The other category is things that exist but are uncreated. So where does Jesus go? He's an uncreated creator. He's before. He's previous. He's not something that God spoke into existence and then created through. He has existed forever in relationship with God. And he has authority to tell you what he made you for. and what it looks like to live in line with that purpose. Now, he does this by giving life and by giving light. Life, obviously, you have life, but it's flourishing. It's not just he made things alive. He brings flourishing. And to receive him and to agree with him and to obey him and to follow him means that you're living in line with your purpose, your reason for being. And he does this by giving light. Now, this isn't just let there be light, but it's the theological version of light, that he provides understanding. He gives illumination. He reveals God's will for you. He reveals what it looks like to live in line with your purpose, to live a life that is actually congruent with your reason for being alive in the first place. So how do you get that? In verse 5, it says, that light shines in the darkness, and yet the darkness did not overcome it. And some of your translations say did not comprehend it or did not understand it. And that's because John uses a word that he can nuance. He's going to use that word again and again throughout his gospel to mean a variety of things. So the ambiguity allows him to say more than he seems to be saying on the page. Who doesn't understand Jesus in the Gospels? It's the religious people. No offense to us, right? But it's the religious people, and especially the religious authorities. They don't understand Jesus. They don't like him. They look at him and say, you think you get to tell me how to live my life, what's good for us and good for Israel? You think you get to determine what a life that is pleasing to God is? We don't like the version you're selling us. So they don't comprehend him. And they try to overcome him by taking him to the cross to die. They're like, you're a problem for us, and we want to kill you. And so John uses that comprehension and overcoming word to mean both. So the light shines in the darkness, but the darkness did not overcome it. How do you get the life, the meaning, the purpose, and the light to live out that life? John says in verse 12 that all who receive him, he gave the right to be the children of God. To those who believe in his name, who were born not of natural descent or of the will of the flesh or the will of man, but of God. How do you get into that life? How do you get into that meaning? How do you comprehend what he's telling you about yourself? It's receiving him. It's believing. But what are you believing? Just in him in general? And I think John puts this verse here because he's going to explore it for the rest of the gospel. What happens when you decide to live a life where you determine the meaning, where you determine the value system, where you determine what leads to flourishing? It's foolish and it's dangerous, but you end up in a place where you can't stand to be around Jesus. Because he's constantly talking about, I've made you for this. I want you to love your enemies. I want you to forgive the people who hurt you. I want you to welcome the stranger. I want you to share your stuff. I want you to use your bodies in a way that contributes to the flourishing of humanity, but also in a way that mimics my fidelity and monogamy to you. He keeps on saying things that are very countercultural for us right now. And so if you reject him, eventually you just have to kill him. You've got to kill him. You've got to put him to death in your heart, so that you can live in a way that you want to live. But if you are willing to take a look and see this claim that he is the pre-existing second person of the Trinity who became a man and gave up everything for you so that he could give you life, you can receive him. And you might say, well, I don't believe that. What am I going to do? I just don't believe it. You know, I'd like to. It's a nice story. And so I hang around church and, you know, I do the things. And it's a nice community to be a part of. You can't believe. Well, belief isn't something you muster up. It's an openness and a trust and the beginning of a relationship of intimacy. And so I'd challenge you. If you can't believe in that kind of God, what's the harm in praying to him? What's the harm in asking him to give you life, to give you light, to help you understand those things you don't understand? The claim of John is that this Jesus went to a cross to be overcome on your behalf, and that the Spirit raised him to new life. He was resurrected, and that he lives now and forevermore, and lives for all. And so if he's really alive, then the same things he's done that have been written down are the same things he can do for you. They're the same things he can do in your life. And so you can ask him, help me understand. Come near to me. I want, but I don't believe. I mean, this is the prayer of the father who asked for healing. Jesus says, do you believe? And he says, I believe, but help my unbelief. Do you have unbelief? Ask God to help you with the unbelief. What happens when you get in, when you receive him by trust? Well, you get the life, that flourishing that we've talked about, but you get a new pattern for life. Jesus is not just the reason for being, the meaning of life, but he is the pattern for life. He shows us the end goal of what we were created to become. And so we live out his life now together in community as we are learning to adopt his lifestyle, as we are learning to obey him and follow him, as we're learning what it means to be truly human, so that we can be in intimate relationship with one another and say, that was beautiful, that reminded me of Jesus. Or that was not in line with who Jesus has created you to be, and I'm concerned for you, brother or sister. You get a family. He gave them the right to be children of God. And that's what we are. For anyone who's given their hope and their trust and their loyalty to Jesus, we've become family. Finally, what we get is that relationship with God. If Jesus existed Jesus existed as the Logos before our story began, and that existence was in relationship with Father, Son, and Spirit, then they are a family of love and joy and explosive creativity. I don't know if you, actually I do know, if you have ever been in love, like real love, you know that love can't help but share. Love can't help but create. Love can't help but be joyful and not self-focused, but focused on the other. The reason you were created was to be a part of that relationship. Jesus Christ came so that you could enter into that relationship of love and joy and creativity and health and flourishing. And so what you get is not just a pattern so that you can be a good person, but you get a partner and a family, a cosmic family that you can be a part of and experience joy and life regardless of your circumstances. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me. There's no other way to God except for through Jesus. You can't work your way there. You can't go through some other intermediary. There is one way to relationship with God, to enter into that family, and it is through Jesus, by giving him your trust and by following him. John says at the end of his book in a couple places, but I'm going to read from chapter 20, verses 30 through 31. He says, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples that are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. John wrote his book so that you would believe that Jesus is alive, that he gave everything up for you, and that he wants relationship with you. And when you enter into that, he gives you life and light to live that relationship out. That's what the book is about. If you're in a place where you're like, I don't know, read the book of John. He's the author. He gets to tell you what the book is about, you know, and what it does. As for us, as a community, as a family of God, who have been brought together because of Jesus' sacrifice for us, what this means is that we have been brought into the very life of God, and that we live that out together, not for our own benefit only, but for the benefit of our neighbors, for the benefit of our coworkers, the benefit of our classmates, the benefit of our family. And so as we get into relationship with God, deeper and deeper in intimacy, he reshapes that reason for being, that meaning of life, so that our priorities are reordered slowly over time. That those things that we think are going to produce life but have found wanting are replaced with the things that Jesus actually says provide life, actually provides meaning, actually provides value. And so wherever you're at, like maybe you're at the beginning of a relationship with Jesus and you're trying to figure out just who he is. Like that's why we have this life together. But maybe you've been following him for a long time, and it just kind of feels boring now. And you do the right things, and you go through the motions, and you sing the right songs, and you join the right groups, but you've forgotten that God has created you for adventure. Like a radical life. Something that actually matters. Something that is actually exciting. And if you haven't felt that, if you haven't felt that God is inviting you into something that's scary, something that's difficult, like maybe you're on the wrong path. Like maybe you're following the wrong Jesus. This is the guy who says, follow me, and then ends up on a cross. If your relationship with God isn't causing some sort of death in you, some sort of letting go, some sort of reordering of priorities, my question is, are you following the same Jesus? Like, what are those things that you think are so exciting that they're worth giving your life up for? If Jesus is the reason and the foundation of being, then he has the authority to tell you what is actually exciting, like cosmically satisfying, and totally terrifying. I don't know when it started. Actually, I do. It was sometime in the last year. It was when we were planning a church. Crystal and I started saying, this is really hard. This is really painful. This is a lot of effort. This is really scary. It's pushing us outside of our comfort zone. And I don't know who said it first. But it was like, well, here's the question. Would you rather read The Lord of the Rings or be in it? I know, nerd. Sorry. Right? But would you rather read the book or be in it? And here's the reality. Whether or not you answer one way or the other, the reality is you are in the book. And maybe life is really hard and you're suffering and it's difficult. There's a different end for the heroes in the book than for the bad guys. But they all suffer. They all go through scary stuff. They all go through hard things. You're already in the book. Do you want to cooperate with the author and discover adventure and flourishing? Or do you want to reject the author's purpose and find yourself a footnote at the end? I'd invite you to be a part of the book, to give your trust to the author, and to find life and light for your life. Let me pray. Lord Jesus, you are King of the universe, and yet you became one of us. And so you know what it is to be confused. You know what it is to suffer. You know what it is to find beauty and enjoy it and find it fleeting. But because you're the King of the universe and because you live for us and because you created all things, you know the end of the story. And you know what you have destined us for, what your desires are for us. And you know where we're at today, and you know what we need from you. I pray that as we turn to you in our response time, you would speak to each of us in a way that we can hear and understand and respond to. That you would give us your life as you have given your life for us. And that you would provide light so that we can see how it is that we can follow you as individuals and as family. Thank you that you are with us now and that you promise to never leave us. I pray that we would experience that now as we turn to you in song, in the cup, in the bread, in prayer, in our giving, in our serving. Meet with us now. Amen.